From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we're having a continuing conversation with Professor Luciana Bone, and we're going to be talking about, as we began doing in the past 2 weeks, the end days of the Soviet Union, which seem particularly apropos right now, as it seems like we may be living through the end days of the U.S. and that whole construct as well. It looks like it's imploding on itself. Watching those hearings, looking at this whole thing with the leaks from the White House, supposedly, and Woodward and the New York Times anonymous source editorials and all this craziness. But we're going to first deal with and see if we can learn from the history of the end days of the Soviet Union. Maybe that will arm us for what's coming here.
Thank you. Thank you, Don. Yes, we're talking about the year 1991. We started talking 2 weeks ago, as Don said. And it's the key year because by December 31st, 1991, there was no longer a Soviet Union. And of course, as we know, Putin called it the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century, which is misinterpreted. I think he qualified it. Do you know in what sense he meant it?
Well, first of all, I agree with the statement.
Yeah, I agree with the statement too.
Because,
but I wonder if there's more to it. If he qualified it.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the four corners of it.
Yeah,
that stuff's not reported
okay.
Here, and even
we agree.
Yep. But in terms of, I do agree with him on that point. And, assuming that he's doing it by measuring the reality, one major reality is we went from a multipolar world, or at least a bipolar world, a multipolar world, to a unipolar world for a period of time, emboldened with the idea, fallacious as it may have been, that it had just won some great struggle, great moral battle that gave it the authority to run the world the way it wanted. And it began almost immediately before the collapse, as a matter of fact. As it was happening, they started to destroy Iraq, a project that's still ongoing.
Panama was bombed first thing.
Yep.
1989.
Yep.
I think that was a test bombing. You remember the bombing of Panama by George Sr.?
Yeah, but that was over here. You know, you've got the Monroe Doctrine operating.
Oh, you're talking
about... I'm talking about declaring war, like, you know, in that hemisphere. And and that was done with the, you know, full cooperation of the Soviet Union at that point. It certainly was not thwarted at all by the Soviet Union.
Well,
and
by 1989. But that's what I mean
by...
At that time, there were commentaries saying, aha, this is testing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And that most likely is true.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, you're right. Not to mention, you know, the dissolution of the Soviet Union were 100 languages and identities and et cetera. Okay. But we start, because it's not talked about much, with the August coup. We continue what we started last week. So just to summarize, the August coup is called coup in Western accounts.
Right.
In reality, it might have been the last stand of resistance by the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and these were big guns. So, but we'll call it a coup for now.
That's what people call it here. You're right.
No.
But it wasn't. As a matter of fact, the coup was already underway, and these were people that represented, you know, the existing order in whatever condition it was in. And they were fighting a coup.
As I will mention, I mean, this is why it's calling it a coup when the coup, the real coup, had been going on since late 1980s and earlier by the Gorbachev moves in contact with Western interests and Western United States. So to call the August coup, which the August event, a coup. Let's not. It's driving me crazy. Let's see if it becomes clear once I explain it. So we'll call it a coup, the August coup for now, and I expect the later history, if it is socialist, will rename it as what we think, or suspect it was, a heroic act of last resistance by members of the CPSU and the KGB to save the USSR. So another thing that we have to be careful about is that there are questions about this coup. And so maybe future history will also determine if this coup was genuine or manufactured to speed right. up the process of disintegration right. of the Soviet Union.
Right, because whatever it was failed. So was it designed to fail?
The
right, because it provoked a response, a public relations opportunity, and yep. essentially all of it can be looked at as a whole narrative and perhaps as a whole design.
Yeah, so we have. That's right. We cannot discount. We have to be a little skeptic because of the way, because it failed.
Right.
But accounts. So I just want to stay on track.
Definitely. Yeah. Let's deal more with the details instead of interpreting it. So, and we can
yeah,
come back
so,
to it. Go ahead.
Yeah. So in 1990. The chairman of the 1990 December, the chairman of the KGB, Khrushchev?
Yes.
Put together, not in hiding or anything, put together a plan in case a state of emergency should occur and what to do. And he involved the ministers, etc.
Right.
Now, so let's just say that what is called the coup originated as a plan to meet an emergency situation.
Right. And that was okay. There was a plan that was being discussed between Khrushchev, who was the head of the Soviet KGB, and Yazov,
and he invited
who was
the ministers, yeah.
From the military. And what we found, what you found, is that George Bush, the president of the U.S. back then, his NSA was monitoring mm-hmm. the communications between the head of Soviet KGB and the military command from December 1990 all the way up to the actual coup in 1991 specifically. So they were in the communications loop, NSA.
Yes, and just let me find the interference of the NSA. Right.
Yep.
So, George Herbert W. Bush.
Right.
Worked with the NSA, monitored communication between Khrushchev and Dmitry Yazov, who was the defense minister, and the communication between these two and the military command posts throughout the Soviet Union were being monitored. And I don't know whose point of view is this,
right.
but signal intelligence show a limited military support of the coup.
Right.
This is Spanish or Italian Wikipedia, okay?
Right.
So I have to... apparently, according to these communications, most of the commanders refused to even receive calls from Moscow. But we have to consider that this might be the Washington narrative anyway. But there is no doubt that Bush made the unprecedented decision to deliver intelligence information to Boris Yeltsin on the coup,
right.
on what was being planned. And also attached to Yeltsin, a communications expert from the United States Embassy in Moscow, assigned to be a minder, Yeltsin's assistant, to secure telephone calls to military leaders. the U.S. Embassy was facilitating the communication by the president of Russia or whatever he was. He was
president of the Russian Federation, yeah.
Yeah, facilitated communication between president of Russia and his military leaders.
Right.
Finally, the NSA actually opposed Bush's decision to share signal intelligence with Yeltsin because they said, once this will compromise the future ability to monitor Russian military communications, so he can't have that. Right. But that says a lot, about how much Yeltsin was in dependent on the United States for guidance in this situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's another aspect to this, too. The military chain of command at this time, this is before December 25th, 1991,
right.
The military chain of command runs from the military to the Soviet government, not to the Russian Federation government, which was, basically just one member state in the Soviet Union. And so... Mm-hmm. Yeltsin's not in that chain of command at this point. They owe their loyalty to the president of the Soviet Union and to the Soviet government, and mm-hmm. so which Yeltsin was not really part of. He was part of the government of one of the constituent republics of the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
which is
he
different.
Was a governor, as
exactly
you put it,
like a governor of Pennsylvania or something.
Right.
So the Joint Chiefs of Staff don't consult with the governor of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's right. And this is what the NSA was doing. But so what else on the coup? Well, so, we have more questions than answer on this.
Well, the interesting part is no matter which was the cart or horse here, meddling. Definitely figures in this. Did Russia do anything resembling any of this in 2016?
Of these crazy maneuvers?
Right. Exactly.
Americana.
Right.
Intrigues and...
Right.
No. Okay, so now this attempted coup in the Soviet Union was a three-day period between August 19 and 21 in 1991, in which a group of members of the government and the KGB, as I said, of the Soviet Union, tried to retake control of the country. And again, it's a matter of who tells the story. Some say they tried to retake control of the country. Others say that they went against democratic reforms, that they were the hardliners.
Right.
So, but I can't occupy two seats, and so I'm going to try to simplify.
Right.
Now, the leaders of the coup were members of the Communist Party, yes, but they were also ministers of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And they did think that Gorbachev's reform program had gone too far, and what apparently triggered the coup was on the 17th, these leaders read the new Treaty of the Union that Gorbachev had put together and was to be signed on the 20th, I think.
Right.
And they concluded that he had negotiated that this treaty dispersed the power of the central government in favor of the Soviet republics. Of course, he was in favor of the Russian Republic to be able to break away. But...
Let me give people a little context for this. At the time that this was happening, there had been excited in a number of the constituent republics of the Soviet Union, in other words, some of the states, some of the other countries besides Russia, the Baltics, for example, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine. Georgia.
Lithuania was the first in 1989.
Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. There was the unrest that was being stirred up. Now, you had the economic conditions had been created that would promote unrest in the first place. And that was ongoing from pretty much from the time that Gorbachev took office. And while that unrest was being manifest, it was being organized in a secessionist mode almost, in an anti-Russian mode, certainly. And so what was being raised was a demand by some dissidents, which were getting huge coverage in the West, out of proportion to their actual popularity at home, but huge coverage, and there's a feedback loop from that, that they should secede from the Soviet Union. And so there was a condition, and a political condition as well, where you had people who were in these local governments, you know, the regional, the republic governments, could see an enhancement of their own power if they could have some of the functions taken from the central government to the local government, like you see going on here from time to time when they argue over the states' rights and pushing funding down to the state level from the federal government and et cetera. So while all that soup was being made, Gorbachev decides that it's time to renegotiate the arrangement and push some of these things out to the republics, you know, some power down to the republics. And he's got Yeltsin demanding that as the head of the Russian Republic and a constituency inside the republic government for that. And he's got, in addition to all of that, this rear guard movement that's starting to develop. And so he thinks that, and he's, again, watching the Western media as well, perhaps the situation is like a runaway train, and if we renegotiate the union and make some concessions to the regional governments, then we can hold this together. And in any event, that's how he tries to sell it. And
that's
so what
right.
happens is, as he puts together this thing that, in essence, reconstructs the Soviet Union, and by the way, changes it. The basis of the Soviet Union is in the terminology. Okay, although there is a formal government structure that looks conventional like what other European governments did, it was actually a union of Soviets. And the Communist Party was integrated into this. And what they were doing was they were going to change the foundational relationships inside the society and create, in essence, a European state or a set of European states that would look more like the EU looks now than the Soviet Union. And that is what provoked opposition.
The most important leaders were, interestingly, Boris Pugov, in the interior minister, who was the interior minister.
Right.
And he and his wife committed suicide on the 23rd, I think, of August. He and his wife, but the rumor is that they were murdered. And the interior minister, of course, is key, is a key ministry. And I don't know how to interpret that, but he did commit suicide. Dmitry Yazov was the defense minister, so in charge of the military, and he was a marshal, the last marshal of the Soviet Union. And then there was the leader of leaders, which was Vladimir Kryuchkov,
right.
Who died in 2007, and he was the chairman of the KGB and author of the plan we talked about way back in December 1990, which was monitored by the NSA, talking about meddling. Okay, so they failed. Maybe it was too little, too late. Two tank divisions of what is called the Red Army were supposed to act and did move to encircle Moscow, but on the 21st they didn't act. The counter-revolutionaries, that is, the anti-coupsters, say that the leaders were supposed to have ordered 250,000 handcuffs and prepared 300,000 detention orders. But I wouldn't blame them if they had, because it was, you know, a revolutionary, anti-revolutionary condition. At
right.
any rate, that's
right.
just gossip.
Right.
So the question is, who benefited? Well, unfortunately, it was the reformists, the counter-revolutionary. This is what happened in several points, about 10 points. The events of this coup undermined the legitimacy the legitimacy of the CPSU because they failed.
Right.
Contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right.
So the Treaty of the Union, however, was scrapped, was not signed.
Right.
The Treaty of the Union of Sovereign States.
Right.
So sovereign states, that was not signed. It was suspended. It will come back under another name in December.
The CIS, right.
Three, the republics opposed to the coup were Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Moldavia,
right.
Or Moldova now. Those, the international forces opposed to the coup were the United States, the EU Parliament, primarily. The Supreme Soviet of Russia, of the RSSF Russia,
Russian Soviet Federated RSFSR, Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic.
Okay. I don't know why they had the F there.
No, it's because it depends on what language. In English, it's Russian Soviet Federated Socialist Republic, but in Russian, for example, it's it would be whatever, Russia, Sovietsky, Socialist Federacy, whatever, Respublika. So there'll be different letters depending on what language. I assume Italian is different also.
Yeah, so the Supreme Soviet of Russia, let's call it, replaces the Soviet flag with the historic Russian flag, that is the tricolor. Now, these are all minor things. This civil society that you talked about produced the kind of spectacle that plays in the West. Oh, a statue is symbolically, you know, like the statue of Saddam. Well, the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Cheka, was demolished. We stood in front of the KGB building in Dzerzhinsky Square, the Lubyanka. Okay, these are minor, but starting on August 24, you got a Rolling Stone effect here. Gorbachev resigned from the position of Secretary General of the Communist Party Soviet Union. On August 24th, Yeltsin transferred the archives of the Communist Party Soviet Union to the authorities of the State Archive. So he removed the file.
And you know, okay, go ahead, because this is processes.
No, please, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, it's okay, because say the next one also.
Okay, on August 25th, look how rapid these things happen. Yeltsin nationalized the properties of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which, you know, were people's property in Russia, including not only party offices and buildings, etc., but also educational institutions, hotels, etc. That's August 25th. On November, I skip to November 30, but I go back to
August. Let's stay on August 25th. What happened here on the 24th, Yeltsin transferred the archives, quote-unquote, of the CPSU to the authorities of the State Archive. That means it nationalized the archives of the CPSU, and then the following day nationalized the rest of the properties. And so what you have essentially here, you have to think about this in the context of, again, what the Soviet Union actually was. What you have is the nationalizing by, in other words, the state taking over the Communist Party and its property. In other words,
of
what you have,
the Soviet Union.
Yes, and on behalf of Russia, there's that aspect too. But here's the part I want to get to. Look at the class character of this.
Mm-hmm.
The Communist Party is the leading authority because it's the Workers' Party. Okay, the workers are. The state is one with the Workers' Party. And what's happening here is that what is about to be exposed as a multi-class state, you've had the development of a bourgeoisie even, but a petty bourgeoisie certainly, over the decade from the late 70s, early 80s forward, with all kinds of black market activity, a whole lot of stuff that was going on, because of money being pumped into the country from outside, you know, Western currency and such. And so what you ended up having happen is the development of classes inside there, and what you have now is a multi-class state, and that state takes over the Workers' Party, the opposite. In other words, it undoes the revolution.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's, I'm telling you, it's mind-boggling. It's it's a counter-revolution, full swing. It's a taking away power from the workers and peasants, the state. Yep. And then skipping to November 30, Yeltsin ended the activity of the CPSU in Russia.
They just shut it down, right?
Okay, so that's November. But on August 24th, Gorbachev created the Committee for the Operational Administration of the Soviet Union. Well, what does that mean? Didn't they have a body that managed the economy?
Yeah, the Soviet economy, not of the Committee for the Operational Administration of the Soviet Economy. Yeah, well, before you had worker and peasant ownership of the government through the Communist Party's management of the country through the government, and the government management of the economy. So consequently, you had, through various agencies, the worker and peasant management and ownership of the economy. And what was happening was these things were being turned on their head, and we're only a year away from when they start parceling out ownership.
Yep. It's going. So don't tell me when Gorbachev says, you know, I was trying to save the Soviet Union and blah, 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 which we'll get to. But then again, on August 24, an important thing happens. The Supreme Rada of Ukraine approves the Declaration of Independence of Ukraine and convenes a referendum in support of the Declaration of Independence, which will happen on December 1st, which will trigger the Belavezha agreement. I mean, that would be the coup de grace. Okay. Several republics follow the example of the Ukraine. From 24 August to 27 October, the following country announced the exit from the Soviet Union: Ukraine, Moldova, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan. The one who delays the exit the most was Belarusia. Which happened on the 8th of December, the very day when the Belavezha agreement will be signed. And so the latest, the two who leave the Soviet Union, the latest was Belarus and Kazakhstan. Now, the only republics that remain in the Soviet Union at the time of the December 8th agreement that will be signed for the dissolution of the Soviet Union were Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan.
I want to take 1 second and insert something here, because in September of 1991, a very important event takes place, and we're gonna end up dropping it after I point this thing out. But this, one of the things that happens in September of 1991 is that the Ministry of Fuel and Energy of the Soviet Union was converted into a joint stock company known as Rosneftgaz. It was privatized. This ends up being the place where people like Khodorkovsky make billions of dollars, and it's the formation of the Russian oligarchy. And these are some of the people that Putin very slowly put back in their cages. And this is something I guess we can maybe pick it up or skirt past that and pick up the rest of the presentation you put together next week. Luciana, thank you so much. This is, to me, so interesting. And really, again, while I'm watching the deconstruction of the world around us occur here, it's interesting to be able to study another example of it.
Yes, there is a certain amount of anarchy, I would say, yes.
Yeah, and also, you got to remember, the people that designed the deconstruction of the Soviet Union are the ones that are working against the administration here. So it's just some of their, you know, their craft at work also in front of us. Okay, thanks. Absolutely. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.